You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's a shocking figure, but around 1.6 million American juveniles run away each year. New York Times Washington Bureau reporter Ian Urbina crossed the country over the past 2 years to track down and interview some of those runaways, and he describes his findings in a two-part series called Running in the Shadows, which was published by the Times on October 26th and the 27th, and it has already generated tremendous response from readers. It's also caught the attention of lawmakers on Capitol Hill, where there is now early talk of a special subcommittee hearing to address the issue. Ian Urbina joins me now. Welcome to our show.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Isn't your regular beat foreign and domestic policy? How did you come to cover this story?
I actually cover the Mid-Atlantic region for the paper, so that's 8 states along the eastern seaboard, and then I do some investigative projects. So I'm sort of all over the map, and this story was born out of a project we did back in 2007, which was an investigation of MAG crews, which are these door-to-door magazine subscription sales crews. The kids come to your door and try to sell you an overpriced, subscription to a magazine. And we investigated what that niche of work is like and found it to be pretty exploitative and illegal in a lot of cases.
And using runaways?
Yeah, I mean, the majority of the kids who get sort of looped into that world came from broken homes, and a good portion of them were indeed runaways, or what are called throwaways, kids who have been thrown out of their homes, and they sort of opted to go on the road with these MAG crews and travel the country, one state per week, usually in van convoys, living in hotels and selling magazine subscriptions. And so we were investigating that world, and I was just sort of taken by that demographic and sort of who these kids are and how they survive and what sort of abuse they're subject to and also just their general outlook and scrappy ingenuity in surviving day to day.
Well, when you began covering this story of runaways, did you expect it to become as big as it did or to take so much time to complete? It took you a couple of years.
It did. Probably no is the simple answer. I didn't expect it to go on this long. I became very interested in the sort of the second day of the series had as its focus sex trafficking of minors or kids that get looped into prostitution, put simply. And I was very interested to figure out that situation and sort of the subset of mostly runaways who fall into that even worse trap, how they're recruited and controlled and how they escape and why they don't sometimes even willingly. And so with that goal in mind, we began this sort of ambitious effort of building a database of convicted and still incarcerated sex traffickers and pimps that then we sent hundreds of letters out to these mostly men and tried to engage them in interview just to sort of learn their perspective and their methods. That was an extremely slow reporting process, as you can imagine. But, a year and a half later, the subset of those individuals who did engage us in conversation through letters, it was worthwhile. It really was a rich way to figure out that component. So that was one of the big reasons for the length of the project. And so, too,
Were people willing to talk to you? I know because there are any number of books out there, pimps tend to be proud of what they do, or some are proud of what they do. Was there a certain bragging aspect to this, or were they reluctant to talk to you because they were serving time for the crime?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you're right. The vast majority were reluctant to talk about it. And there was an unusual uniformity in the refrain that many of them used in their letters upon the initial request, which was the game is to be sold, not told, which was their way of saying they would tell their story only if paid, which, of course, we can't do. But there was a small, you know, subset. I'd say we sent out maybe 250, 300 letters, and we ultimately, you know, got in conversations with, you know, substantive responses from, you know, 60 or 70. And most of them were indeed defensive, if not proud, of the life they'd chosen, and argued that they were more talent agents than exploiters of the youth that they, quote-unquote, worked with. But they, at the same time, you know, they also recounted in less guarded moments very, you know, often violent means of control and manipulative methods of recruitment.
What about the runaways? How many did you wind up interviewing, and how do you even locate them? Because the successful runaways are trying to avoid detection, aren't mm-hmm. they?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Ultimately, we interviewed, I would say, over 85 runaways in about 7 different states, some of them by phone, usually set up with the help of child welfare workers or advocates that interface with the runaways directly. We also visited 5 states, trying to find, you know, the best group that we could follow. You know, for the reason you point out, it was really tough to find a group that would not only talk to me, but also would allow me and a photographer to follow them around for a while and really sort of let us in. I'd say 90% of the contacts we made were made with some sort of social service provider as the intermediary, you know, sort of small local groups that do outreach with these youth and that would vet us first and then would make introductions and sort of oversee our interactions, at least at the outset, to make sure that they felt it was safe for those youth to be talking with us and to be as candid as often they were.
And they even gave their real names in many cases.
Mm-hmm.
The headline in your first article is "Recession Drives Surge in Youth Runaways," and it focuses on a group of teenagers living in the streets of Medford, Oregon. What drew you to this town in particular?
Well, there's a pretty amazing group there that's called the Maslow Project, which, again, is one of these sort of small, overworked, under-budgeted nonprofits that does outreach work to at-risk youth and mostly sort of street youth. Just in hearing from sort of dependable sources about the Maslow Project, I felt like they would be a good organization to reach out to. And then in interacting with Maslow directly, I was really impressed by the work they did, and they were willing to sort of trust us and let us in. And so we made an initial trip out there to see what Medford was like, because I'm from the East Coast and I had no idea what the town would be like, and to meet the kids and see if they were willing to allow us to follow them around. And it just, it's an amazing spot for its, frankly, its bleakness. You know, Medford is this sort of town that sprawling kind of forgotten place where no one seems to be on the streets, and meth has pretty much ravaged the entire area, and there are lots of people just sort of walking around aimlessly, a lot of abandoned houses, and it was just, you know, it just was a really compelling place. And then the kids themselves that we met were also really genuine and straightforward and trusting, and so it just seemed like a good place to use as the centerpiece for the first day.
My guest is Ian Urbino, whose series of articles in the New York Times is Running in the Shadows, ran on October 26th and the 27th. I'm thinking about the great Pacific Northwest. Mary Ellen Mark did a series of photographs of street people, most of them runaways. Is there something in the water up there?
I don't know. It's a good question, because there is Portland is almost famous for its street culture and its youth, its prevalence of runaways and street youth. I don't know.
So do you think runaways go to a place because they hear that other runaways have gone there?
Well, I have heard that, but especially for places, you know, New York City and San Francisco and L.A. are sort of famous magnets for runaways. You know, there is a disproportionate percentage of runaways who are gay and who often leave home for reasons of tensions over their sexuality. And one draw I've heard from advocates to the cities is that the notion that there will be more people like them and it'll be a more accepting place. And they can also disappear more easily in a more densely populated area than the small town often that they come from. But that doesn't explain Medford or Portland. So I just don't know why they're drawn there. I never got that answer.
Well, what were the reasons that they gave you that they had run away from home? Is the economic downturn a factor? Because you said this was a rather depressed area.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly, from what I heard, it's certainly an important factor. But one of those factors that's a couple layers removed from the symptoms. So in other words, a lot of the kids talked about when they told their, they wouldn't say the recession drove me to where I am now. What they would say is things really took a turn for the worse when my dad lost his job. And when you dug a little bit, you would find out that, you know, the dad lost the job in the last year and a half. And often things were not great to begin with, quite frankly. A lot of these kids were coming from fairly broken homes to start with. But we were especially interested in, you know, the bulk of runaways, that 1.6 million figure you mentioned at the outset, return home, you know, within days or weeks. We were more interested in the, you know, the quarter of that percentage, the quarter of that number that stay out and don't go home.
The long-term runaways, who are chronically homeless, aren't they?
That's right. Yeah, and those folks are ones that are not leaving home because of a spat with mom or a desire not to do chores or something of the like. These are folks that are leaving often abuse at home, physical or sexual or otherwise.
Sometimes their parents are addicted to drugs as well.
That's right. A lot of the cases involve addiction on the part of the parents, and a number of cases that I'd say at least six kids we interviewed had parents who had lost their home to foreclosure. One of the girls featured in the story, a 16-year-old girl, was actually still living in her now abandoned, foreclosed family home, and she was breaking into it to stay there.
And her parents didn't mind that she was living in their foreclosed home and had run away?
The parents had. She was a sort of more complicated, quote-unquote, runaway in the sense that her parents had moved away when they lost their home, and they'd moved to a trailer park a ways away. And this girl, Nikki Hall, very much wanted to finish school. And where her parents were living, there was no way she could get to the school she currently attended, and she didn't want to start. Mm. She was a rising senior, and so she was living on her own in the family home, and they actually did not mind that she was there. They thought it was risky and illegal, but they also saw her point in wanting to finish off her schooling.
Well, it sounds kind of mature on some levels, but she seemed to have very limited skills, and you say that most of these kids, the kids you met in Medford, act like children.
Mm-hmm.
I would assume that they would have grown up very quickly by necessity.
Yeah, I mean, I think you strike on something that most attracted me to this demographic. I mean, in one way, these are very stilted kids in their maturation, and they almost seem immature compared to their age peers. And in another way, they're often really street savvy and more kind of streetwise than certainly I am and many adults I know. And so they're this odd mix. I mean, you know, We mentioned in the story, you know, one kid who still sucked her thumb and yet, you know, never left the park without her switchblade, you know. And, you know, you ask them how to, you know, get food stamps or how to, when they really hit rock bottom, run out of money, where they can go to get more money. And they have, you know, a repertoire of pretty skilled and savvy methods. But you ask them about sort of cooking pasta or sort of how they might re-enroll in school or, bigger issues like, you know, might it make sense to start figuring a path out of their current situation? And these questions are, you know, beyond them.
My guest is Ian Urbina of the New York Times. His two-part series called Running in the Shadows was published on October 26th and 27th, and it is still generating a tremendous response from readers, and I gather also has caught the attention of lawmakers. Later we'll talk about what officials, authorities can do to change this situation, if anything. But first, we're going to take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Ian Urbina of the New York Times, whose series Running in the Shadows was published on the 26th and 27th of October. Some of these kids are ingenious in being able to stay alive. You came across Clinton Ankers, who's been living on the streets for 6 years. How did he learn to survive for 6 years on his own, and how could he escape detection for so long?
Well, I mean, he's just a smart kid is the simple answer, and a tragic story also. I don't know. I can't go back to the beginning. All I can say is that he came from a family where at an early age, he was in the Boy Scouts, and he and his father would go hunting. And so he had a bit of an outdoorsman set of skills to start with, which I think has helped him a lot, because unlike most of the other kids, at least in this one pack that we featured, Clinton almost preferred to get out of the city and into the woods, whereas the other kids tended to like to stay closer to the city, or such as Medford is a small city. But he's just a savvy sort of kid who reads people well and is very quiet. For that reason, I mean, a lot of these kids were not like Clinton in their personality, in that they were really rambunctious and attracted attention, and often negative attention, and ultimately calls to the police, because they were mouthing off at people walking through the park or looking too young to be smoking and drinking or whatnot, whereas Clinton was much more adept at being invisible, and I think that partially explains how he's been able to survive out there so long.
Is there a sense of community among these kids and the homeless community in general?
Yes, to the first question. I didn't delve beyond, the world that these kids live in was so all-encompassing that once I was in it, I didn't leave it. So I didn't get a sense for the adult homeless community in Medford. But within the posse that I was following of kids, there was an unusually strong sense of community and almost hierarchy. There were two boys in particular who were seen as sort of the deciders of the group, Clinton being one of them and another kid named Alex. And they had real strict, unstated, at least while I was there, rules about drug use, hard drug use. And they all seemed to smoke pot. But hard drug use was really frowned upon, and I think that may be because a lot of them had parents who were using. But they also were very protective of the younger. There was a girl, a 14-year-old girl, who had recently joined up with this group, and she was very stubborn, bullheaded, and generally clueless about really what the dangers were out on the streets, especially sort of sexual predator dangers. And the boys, Alex and Clinton, spent a lot of their time trying to figure out what to do with Betty, is her name.
She Betty was Snyder. Her mother beat her, and that's the reason she ran away. In the case of Clinton, he's 18 now. He's an adult. I don't know whether he stays with the kids or whether he moves into another world there. But can he ever get a job?
Well, I mean, Clinton's, yes, is a simple answer. I mean, Clinton, 18 is a number. If you met Clinton, you wouldn't think of him as an adult. His wisdom, certainly, but, experience, he doesn't seem like an adult. But the series triggered a really surprising sort of outpouring of generosity from readers, and a lot of them were very taken with Clinton, and a lot of them offered, sent donations to the Maslow Project, which set up an education fund for the kids that were featured in the story. And one reader actually stepped forward and offered Clinton a place to live, and Clinton has since moved in with that family and is now enrolled in college is off the streets. So, and he's a very, aside from being savvy, street savvy and wise, he's also smart in the sense that he's very good with his hands and is really sharp with computers, and he can build computers and had helped the Maslow Project fix theirs a bunch of times, all self-taught. And so he's enrolled in a computer engineering program at the local community college.
I'm speaking with Ian Urbino of the New York Times. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You talked about the sexual predators. One-third of these runaways end up trading sex for food, for shelter, for money, all the things they need to live. I actually would have thought it might have even been higher. Do they do it on their own, or is it always the case that some pimp finds them and sends them out on the streets?
No, I mean, a lot of them, and I use that term loosely because I don't have and I don't think exist any concrete statistics, but from reporting it does seem that a lot of the kids engage in the barter of survival on their own, sort of they're couch surfing, and there's an unspoken sort of exchange for permission to remain there. And these sorts of exchanges are occurring all the time, and there's no pimp involved, and it's still exploitative, but not the type of exploitation and scariness, frankly, that we ended up focusing on, which is the pimp controlled prostitution mostly girls get looped into, and the world that exists there is really a separate place entirely, and pretty horrific.
Do the pimps just simply go into certain areas, knowing that they're going to find runaways? Do they look for a certain type of girl?
Yeah, I mean, when I started this, I thought, well, that can't be, that the pimps would post up at specific places and, net people like fish. Just didn't seem intuitively possible. And at the end, in fact, that is what they do.
And are the girls aware of who they are and what their business is?
Well, and that was also a surprise. Oftentimes they are. The pimps, the ones that I interviewed that I trusted were being straight, said that they often made a point of saying it up front because they didn't want to waste their time with girls with surprises down the road. There was, a percentage, there's a sort of subset of those who engage in a certain sort of trickery, I'll give you a place to stay, and I'll look out for you, and then after sort of playing the friend / daddy figure, the pimp, or new boyfriend or new friend, whatever, turns around and says, okay, now, I helped you, you need to help me, I heard a lot of stories of that method used as well.
And this is only with girls. Boys often turn to prostitution as well, especially gay runaways. Is their system different than what you see with the girls?
I found it to be, yeah. Boys, exactly as you say, there is a whole world of, and it often has its own track, meaning its own section where those selling this quote-unquote service go, and it's its own separate realm. And there is a prevalence of runaways. They're engaged in that. But the boys who get involved in that, and the be it straight or trans involvement, rarely are pimp controlled. And I can't offer an explanation. I'm sure an academic could, but there usually isn't even a madam or an intermediary, as there is in other forms of prostitution. And these are usually individual players who are acting on their own.
Now, what happens when these kids are arrested for prostitution? Are they treated as criminals or are they treated as victims?
Well, it's a big question, and it varies a lot department to department, state to state. I mean, the general norm, unfortunately, is that they're arrested and charged and generally handled as criminals because, indeed, they are breaking a law. But the increasing awareness, the growing sort of perception is shifting, and the methods of handling these kids is shifting, so that police departments are recognizing that these are kids, and as such, they perhaps shouldn't be treated as perpetrators or criminals, but rather should be seen as victims and thus should be handled as high-risk victims who need perhaps to be detained, but most importantly need to be provided services, therapy, and a path out and a way to break from their situation with their pimp and living on the streets.
Couldn't police improve their record of helping runaways just by entering their names into a federal database?
Yes. I mean, that was one of the biggest findings of the second day of the series. So there is, as you say, there is this federal database. It's called NCIC. And it's sort of the repository of all criminal activity. And, you know, so when you get pulled over and they run your plates, or they're usually running it off of the federal database to see if there are any warrants out on you or whatnot, it's a very important tool. And there's a law that has been around since 96 but was 2 years ago tweaked that basically says if a missing person report is filed, be it on an adult or on a child, by at a local police station, the local police are required to enter the information from that missing person report into the federal database within 2 hours. And this was especially important with regard to children, because if Janie goes missing and Janie's mom files a report at the local police station, and the local police do not enter the information into the federal database, the minute Janie leaves that immediate area, that jurisdiction, she's invisible. She's entirely off radar. So if she's picked up a town away, a state away, across the country, if someone stops her at a, you know, at a bus station and thinks something looks suspicious, which often happens, and they run her name, nothing is going to come back. And so they'll have very little way to detain her because of that, you know, requirement wasn't followed. And we crunched, you know, we got some good data because we've been hearing time and again from parents and child advocates that police simply don't handle runaways. They don't take them seriously, and they don't handle the report seriously.
People sometimes don't even spot them. There was that article in the Times that was a kind of a follow-up to your series about a 13-year-old kid named Francisco Hernandez Jr. who spent 11 days last month in the New York City subway undetected. This is an Asperger's kid, which means that he probably had certain skills. On the other hand, that's 11 days. That's a long time.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
A caller wants to know about the racial and ethnic mix of these runaway kids. In Oregon, I'm assuming most of them were white. Is that
true? That's right. Yeah, I mean, and that was sort of the nature of where we ended up reporting the story from, you know, provided a sort of visual that doesn't necessarily correspond to the reality. But on the so all the kids in the pictures and the videos we had for the series were all white. There were a couple of African-American kids and two Latino kids who were in the mix, but they weren't really comfortable with being part of the story, so they remained out. But nationally, it's a little surprising that there is a disproportionate number of kids of color who are runaways. And what I've seen as the explanation for that is that that is the result of the fact that a disproportionate number of kids running away are coming from foster care, and a disproportionate number of the kids in foster care are of color. And so that's the reason for the skewing. If you look at the kids who are running from private homes, from families, it's actually fairly split down the middle. So there are an even distribution of white and non-white kids running away.
Just one more thing, Ian. Sarah in Queens wants to know what your take is on the Oregon runaway laws, which make it legal for a teen to run away from his or her home. That's is that unique to Oregon?
I don't know the answer to that, honestly. Nor do you know. I don't have a firm take as well. Not to be flighty, but. I've heard both critiques of that, which make it, I think the standard critique is that making it so easy for kids to leave home affords them with a decision power that is risky and it ties the hands of the state to intervene when there needs to be intervention. They get involved in drug or crime or some sort of exploitative sort of sex trafficking type scenario. There's even less that social workers and the state generally can do to intervene.
In just a minute or so, is there anything the government can do to change the situation, to improve it?
Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, we focused on the Dallas Police Department, which has this special unit, which has a whole different way of approaching these kids that get looped into prostitution and runaways and repeat runaways generally, and really sort of a more proactive, almost preventative medicine type of way of handling them. That program has had amazing returns. So I think that's one way. And then funding, you know, it all comes back to money. There's just very few programs out there for helping these kids get off the streets and get treatment and therapy and a path into school.
There's at the New York Times website, there are videos that correspond to the story, so you can get a more in-depth sense of what we've been talking about. My great thanks to Ian Urbina, whose series, Running in the Shadows, was serialized in the New York Times on October 26th and 27th. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.